Call the order of the Flood Resilience Committee meeting for Monday, July 31st. It's good to see everybody here. Hard to believe it's still July, but I think this is a month we'll all be glad to see in the rearview mirror. It has been hot. Before we get started, I want to commend our team Mount Pleasant for the turnout for the South Carolina 7 event on the bridge for the Mayor's Bridge Walk. I think we had 40 people on our team hike the bridge. David, you were there. It was great. The role this town played in that statewide thing, I don't know if y'all know, but the town, we were the only municipality that was one of the sponsors. And we got high praise from Mr. Mulliken, who is also the chair of the State Floodwater Commission, which issued their statewide resiliency plan on June 29th. So it was a good day for Mount Pleasant. I appreciate everybody's participation in that. And then we hosted a roundtable discussion at Alhambra, mostly about seabirds and shorebirds. It was called Crab Bank and Beyond, because Crab Bank is such a conservation win for business, for the town, for the birds, for the harbor deepening project. So it was a great month for conservation, for resiliency, and for the town of Mount Pleasant. Item number two is approval of the minutes from our May 1st meeting. So I have a motion and a second. Any discussion? All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Item three is public comments. If you would like to make a public comment, please come forward, give name and address in 2.5 minutes to speak, please.
My name is Daniel Mullen. I'm 577 Wood Spring Road, treasurer of the Commonwealth Property Owners Association. And basically, I just want to thank the town of Mount Pleasant for a lot of the work that they've already done in our neighborhood, clearing several driveway pipes that on Commonwealth that's made are kind of a big difference. Now the neighbors and everyone can see the grade problems of the ditch work, because you got a clearing pipe, but the ditches are now still full. But that was great. I want to thank you. And also I want to thank Kevin. Kevin's been working very hard on our outfall issues. And what I wanted to bring up is it's a very complicated outfall design, because the real root cause, in my opinion, and a lot of neighbors, is we don't get the tidal cycles during these big storm cycles. The creek is so small at the back end, no outfall will work if the level is higher at the creek. And so our design, really, we have to minimize what that water can come into this 5-acre lake to give us time to bridge the tidal cycle. So he's working on that, and very much appreciated. So, but I do want to emphasize that it's a very complex problem with that Alston Creek. And that has been compounded by the Carolina Park, because that used to be 800 acres. Mm. Now that has to drain through this little 6-foot creek. Right. So, that's all I need to say, but I do want to thank Mount Pleasant.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
We appreciate it. Anyone else for public comment before we close it? None? All right. We will move on to item number four, discussion of building practices in flood zones. We have a few people that are going to serve as resources for us. And would you like to sort of set the table? You put this on the agenda? Mm-hmm. Just sort of.
I did. This is something that I've thought about a long time, witnessed happening in my backyard, and just found it to be not a great way to be doing development in Mount Pleasant and the Low Country. So I've reached out to some people in the community that have been working on this type of project, and the city of Charleston recently passed an ordinance, so I thought it was time for Mount Pleasant to start talking about possibilities for doing things in a better way over here.
Okay, and they're here today.
Right. We have Anna Zimmerman is here.
There's her.
Yeah.
Anna Zimmerman from the College of Charleston, and Dale Morris.
Dale Morris from the city of Charleston.
Did you want to go first?
Ask them just to speak for a couple of minutes, and
sure.
then we could follow up with
whatever
what the town has.
Yeah,
to show.
Dale, do you want to go first?
Anna? Dr.
Mark, we'll let you give us some background, and then it'll be all yours.
Absolutely.
That'll work great. Thank you. Right here, please. just introduce yourself.
Yeah, so my name is Anna Zimmerman. I am a professor at the College of Charleston. My background is that I have degrees in biology, immunology, and marine science. Before coming to the College of Charleston, I did a postdoc at MIT, and flooding was not really something that I thought would be in my trajectory in life, but I became an unintentional flood activist, and I credit that due to moving to Charleston and being an unsuspecting homeowner that thought that they did their due diligence. I had a house that flooded actually due to illegal building practices that were going on. So I know a lot about base flood elevation, the possibility of what you're looking at when the only way to get out of a house that you own is either to offload it to someone else, or as in my case, my family actually went through a foreclosure situation, and we tried to make an example of everything that we have identified that had gone wrong with existing building practices. Look at us. Nobody wants to be us, but learn from us. Do better than what happened to us. Do better than what happened to the five sets of grandparents on our street. Do better than what existing homeowners now, I view it as being a decadal nightmare to them. And so what can we do better? What can we learn? And so I come here today sharing perspective. I have been able to escape this and bring my family to I don't have to live in flood anymore, but I know that a lot of people do live in flood. And so I've tried to shape a lot of what I've done in the last couple of years with flood advocacy to learn everything that I can. And if that means going to Washington, D.C. and talking to FEMA, I will do it. If that means going to Texas, learning from flood conferences, I will do it. If that means spending months of my life reading about building codes, I will do it. And all of that has been to either understand what went wrong or try to do better or try to help my neighbor. So I come to you as a flood advocacy. I don't have a dog in the fight. I've really lost all equity that I ever thought that I put into a home. I have already witnessed tremendous suffering, and the suffering that has probably moved me the most, if this just happens to me, my go-get 'em attitude would be, well, I'm just going to regroup and move on. But it was that I could regroup and move on, but the five sets of grandparents that were my neighbors could not. The vulnerable children could not. The divorces that I saw, people throwing televisions against their walls, people crying, I just felt like it's not okay to just put one step in front of the other and move on. So I put one step in front of the other, even though I'm dragging the foot, and I will continue to try to be that advocate. So what Lord has asked me to come here today is to just discuss a bit about my perspective and also fill and build development. And so fill and build is a term that actually was coined by myself and Dr. Phil Dustin, and he's also a professor at the College of Charleston. And that was something that as teachers, we were trying to think, what is a way with, when we're teaching, we try to explain things in that people get it. And so fill and build, those three words have been something that now is taking on a national definition. We've been quoted in the New York Times, in Time Magazine. We're seeing this coming up in legislation in other states, fill and build. And those three words are what I would say is something that Charleston can be a leader for, not Pleasant could be a leader for, but people get it. People get the first poster that we put up in social media that said burn, fill, and build. National Flood Group started contacting us that these three words, fill and build, resonate with a lot of problems that are going around all over this country. So what does that mean? In the simplest definitions, and I guess since fill and I coined the term, we can make up our own definition to that lexicon, would be that it would be clear cutting, which would be cutting all of existing vegetation, grading, and filling it in with the wrong kind of dirt, elevating that area with that dirt, and then building houses on top of it. So the fill would be creating this surface that you can basically dump a bunch of dirt onto, and then build would be building on top of it. And you can build on top of it either using like crawl spaces, but the city's ordinance is addressing the slab on grade. I kind of view that as like you have a cupcake with some frosting on top, and the city is looking at the garnish on the top of the cupcake, but they're not looking at maybe the cake itself and the frosting, and we need to look at the fill and build before we would address the slab on grade. So the environmental aspects of clear cutting, that's pretty apparent. It destroys existing trees, existing root structures. It totally changes water absorption patterns. The gravity of making this flat surface with all this extra dirt is bound to change what the existing runoff is. And unfortunately, in areas such as where we live, we don't really understand where that stuff is going to drain. The dirt that's used, I would suggest, and I suggest this to my students, go look at the puddles. Go look at the puddles. Go look at these new housing developments. When it rains, go see if it's draining. It's not draining in many places. Your own eyes will not deceive you. If you see that it's not draining, how on earth can we think that what we have destroyed sometimes by grading this and putting dirt would destroy the existing water capacity of that land? But we've basically put up a parking lot in many of these places. And the dirt, it can run off to other houses. It increases the chance of flooding. Water typically goes downhill. In Charleston, that thought proved me wrong, in that I stood on the street in Jones Island and watched water run uphill. And that happened when flooding happened, and if you happen to have a drain on your street, it can act like a bow, and I saw water coming up storm drains and going uphill and flooding houses. So your own eyes will not deceive you. Look at the puddles. Look at some of this runoff going where they're building these things, and look how you can't even see the water. It's so turbid, so you know this is running off. That can't be good for the environment. As a biologist, you know, we used to talk about building land, like, how is this going to hurt the animals that live there? And that leads me to the next thing that I want to talk about. It seems like we didn't talk about how this is going to hurt nature or the animals. We now are the animals. How is this going to hurt the existing people? And so I was an existing homeowner in Charleston and lost my house. And so I look at fill and build as something that we need to talk about. It's something that's going on. We all have eyes. This is a practice that maybe makes previously undesirable land can be developed, but maybe it's naive to think what's wrong with leaving wetlands wet. And I've been told time and time again that's not a realistic perspective because people own that land and they want to develop that land. Well, that's where even city councils come in, and that's where building ordinances come in. And so if you would leave it for example, outlaw in the floodplain. Other jurisdictions are considering it. Well, it just makes it so that that land, if you wanted to build on it, you would have to build higher, build smarter. That will cost the developers more, but it would cost a new homeowner more in buying that. But your first duty as government is, and all of our duty in community, is to protect the existing people that are already here. And so I'm a huge, thank you for inviting me to that conversation, but I think this conversation, banning fill and build, is something that we have to look at. We have to look at the whole cupcake, not just the garnish of what we do with slab on grade. Fill and build, as it exists today, it increases risk to all the surrounding property owners. You don't have to be a rocket scientist. You don't have to be an engineer. You don't have to be a floodplain manager to go to these places where development is happening and look who's around them and look and say that this will increase the risk to the neighboring properties. The person that's not represented in some of these conversations, I feel like, is the developer. Sure, they're represented. They want to fill and build. They want to build slab on grade, the cheapest possible houses that they can. But the existing homeowner, the fill and build next to them, puts them at higher risk for flooding. Secondly, however, the garnish that's put on the top of, like, well, we just, it's a compromise to not have slab and grade. Is it a compromise, or is it we're trying to address this is the problem? It's not really addressing the problem. Slab on grade, if you're going to say, well, we're not going to allow slab on grade, you have just told every single homeowner in an adjacent neighborhood that they will be in jeopardy of not being able to rebuild their home when it floods. If I could say that again in a shorter way, I would say that again. I have faced that. I have faced that looking into, I cannot rebuild to code with my house not costing more than the equity that I already have in it. At that point in time, I stood and looked at my house and realized this house is going to cost me more to get rid of it than if it just burned down. And that is the, when we're talking about the garnish of the slab on grade, I would hope that every jurisdiction that is even considering that goes through and figures out how many properties will be affected by not being able to rebuild back to code. If you think FEMA is going to come in and save you, I have my FEMA insurance. $168,000 was what we were supposed to get. That's $30,000 to destroy our house. I had all of that rescinded by FEMA, and FEMA told me, this is something that you need to take the city of Charleston to court over. It is not FEMA's problem. It is the city's problems with building codes and how the city has not reported substantial damages. So I would say, as a person that's trying to advocate, every single decision that moving forward with some of these ordinances, it really should not be how do we get more people to put into harm's way, and how do we appease developers, how do we appease, well, let's make compromises that you can do this and still develop it. Every single decision should be looking at how do we protect the existing people that are here, and what will any of these mandates or ordinances do to those folks in the case of increasing flooding to them, will it increase flooding to them? If that's okay with me to say, well, it will increase flooding to them, go and tell your constituents that, you know, you're comfortable making these decisions that will increase flooding to them. I don't think anybody wants that. I don't think anybody wants to flood out their neighbor, but the consequences of making that the existing homeowner, the only reason that they're not in arms is because they are unsuspecting. I know what that's like to your general person does not have an idea of if my house floods, it's going to be 50% damage, which means I have to bring it up to code, and you're not the best bring it to code. They don't totally understand that. And also this idea of thinking like someone will save you. Why didn't somebody save me? I went to FEMA.
penny wasn't going to save me. I went to the city. The city wasn't going to save me. If we think that FEMA is going to save people or bylaws are going to save people, we need to think, how can we save ourselves? And saving ourselves are the people that are here now. And if we think that others will save you, you're going to really come up short and realize that you don't matter. And if someone else is going to save you, maybe we should be thinking as a society, how can we stop doing what we're doing to put people in harm's way? So that's kind of what I have to say.
I appreciate it. We need to.
Yeah, absolutely. Time.
Thank you.
But if you have any questions, reach out to me. I do have that perspective of a homeowner.
Thank you. Dale Morris was City of Charleston Chief Resilience Officer. If you will tell us, you know, in a lot of things we do, whether it's noise ordinances, e-bike regulations, all these things, we learn from what other municipalities have done. If you would give us an idea of your history from actually enacting something and I guess enforcing or at least working, enforcement might not be the right word, but enacting and putting it into practice, I'd appreciate it.
Great. Thank you, Mayor Haney. Dale Morris, Chief Resilience Officer for the City of Charleston, previously with the Water and Sewer Gulf, a technical applied research organization that looks at flood risk mitigation across the Southeast U.S. and Gulf Coast. Prior to that, 24 years, the Dutch government's climate and adaptation flood risk mitigation leader in the United States. So I have a perspective on this and some deep understanding. I'm an American, but I work for the Dutch. Let's put that out there. Came to the city a couple of years ago. In 2019, Mayor Tuckenberg asked myself and David Wagner to bring a Dutch dialogues process to the City of Charleston. This is what would the Dutch do with this problem? So we did those in 2019. And Anna was part of this, and she was in the middle of this awful situation she was in. I sympathize with what she's been through and the effect upon her. She raises a lot of very important questions. City of Charleston can't go into all of those because this is federal, national, development policy, entitlements, all those things. I'm going to tell you what the city did, what the City of Charleston did. The Dutch Dialogues Report in 2019 had looked at development in certain areas of the city. We had four specific places to look at, one of which was John's Island as a greenfield sort of area that was developing, and was it being developed in an appropriate way? What we saw out there was the fill and build, the raising of the trees, the lifting of the first, you know, foot, 6 inches, 8 inches, a foot of a mucky, spongy soil way, and then putting sand on top of that to a certain elevation so then you could put slab on grade on top of it. Our team said, well, this may not be the wisest thing because the quality of the fill may slough water up downstream. You've got these roofs and roads coming in there. That's going to slough off water downstream. You're not understanding the hydrology of the basin, the place where you're at with the unknowns, as well as downstream, and what might be possible upstream to manage that entire water flow. Late 2019, City Council of Charleston considered a ban on fill ordinance. That went nowhere, did not pass. 2020, the same issue came up because this issue of fill, slab on grade, what it was doing to nearby neighborhoods. Again, the ordinance proposal did not pass. I came to the city in late 2021, and I was asked to lead a group with stakeholders. So the environmental groups, the Coast Conservation League, the Southern Environmental Law Center, Historic Charleston Foundation, the Home Builders, the Trident Realtors, and the Chamber of Commerce, City Planning, and City Stormwater. And we got together and said, how do we address this problem in a smart, sensitive way? We worked through this. We looked at what happened in Houston and Harris County, Texas, post-Hurricane Harvey, because there you saw a requirement of 3 feet BFE in the floodway, as well as the ban on fill in the floodway. So we don't have floodways here in Charleston. We just have tidally impacted areas. So we looked at that, and we looked at previous FEMA studies. And studies done by the Louisiana Watershed Initiative that indicated that, yes, there will be an increase in the price of a home for construction when you switch from eliminating slab-on-grade foundations to moving to pier on beam and stem walls. So getting the structures out without above a certain elevation, but without putting fill down. The evidence suggests that that's 2 to 3 to 4% increase in the price of the construction of a home for the first 2 to 3 years. And then after that, as the labor market and the construction market adapts to that, that price increase goes away because, again, there's efficiency in the home builders if that would occur. So what we did in the city of Charleston is, okay, let's see if we can eliminate fill in the 100-year floodplain, starting with the 100-year floodplain, and that's 57% of the city of Charleston. So we have a lot of areas that are in the 100-year floodplain, and ban the use of fill, and require, we decided to ban soil on grade foundation in the 100-year floodplain, which will eliminate the need for fill to get to the design flood elevation. That's what we did. This ordinance will go into effect in 2024, and we've agreed with these same stakeholders that in 18 months, we will look back and see what the impact of this was upon flooding, upon home building, upon the whole sort of process. And then, if possible, we will ponder, consider the evidence, and see if we can get this extended to the 500-year floodplain. That is what we have done. We'll stand by it. We need to learn from this. Other groups are looking at us. Other cities are looking at us to see if we what we learn from this. This new ordinance applies to new single-family detached and attached flood home residences. It doesn't apply to commercial properties because they have different needs, and you may in fact need to have some fill in there and first floor occupancy for purposes of the business. Again, for any home that is going to be redeveloped, whatever the cause, from a fire, because they've sold it and the new builder wants to, the new owner wants to do something with it. If the foundation on that home is going to be improved or expanded, it needs to comply with this new ordinance. If the homeowner is just going to, because the house burned down, they just want to rebuild what they were, they do not have to comply with this. So we're trying to have an equitable sense here of what's going on. But if the new owner is going to redevelop this and crack the foundation, so to speak, change the foundation, then they will need to comply with this. That's what we've done. And I will say this on behalf of the city of Charleston. We are presently developing a comprehensive integrated water plan. It's not an engineering plan. It's sort of how do we stay here in 25 to 30 years. We're assuming 14 inches of sea level rise in that comprehensive water plan. We have mapped what this will mean for a lot of the city of Charleston. And by extension, because of the way the mapping works, we have information on Mount Pleasant. We have also done, and Shannon Whitehead's here from Mount Pleasant, we also work together with the town of North Charleston, city of Charleston, county of Charleston, and Mount Pleasant to get modeling done for us for the next 67 years of what sea level rise and sort of IPCC recommendations regarding emissions and what that means for rainfall. That modeling has been done, and we will share that with you at a certain point. It is a disturbing set of models. It's not guaranteed to happen, but it's indicative of what could happen. We are not saying you cannot live here, but what we are saying with this, what you can see this modeling, is that we're going to have to change our processes to be able to stay here safely and protect what we have. And I'll leave it at that. This ordinance is one of those changes we need. There are more to come. So thank you.
Thank you very much. As he said that, I want to give a little context. For those of us that lived in the area during Hurricane Hugo, if we remember before that, we did not have to have all the hurricane clips, have to have the metal straps that go from your rafters down through the piers down to your foundation and everything. And that was radically new and different after Hugo. This is how we survived the next one. Well, we haven't had one in 30 years, not like that. But now that's the norm. That's how houses are built to be resilient for wind and storm damage. And, you know, I was a young man, owned my first home then, had hurricane damage and all that. If you had told me that now that I'm an old man that would be talking about water coming up from the ground, I would not have thought that was a threat 30-something years ago. But here we are, and I appreciate that. Appreciate both of y'all's perspective. Let me get Katie back up here. And I know our staff has prepared some things about this. So let me turn it over to you and, sure. and give us what you got.
Sure. So Katie Gerling, I'm the floor plan manager for the town. Been here a little over a year. Previously worked for Charleston County and before that, Folly Beach. So excited to be here. Dale and Anna covered a few of the items that's already in the presentation. So hopefully we'll get through this quick and get through our other items. But like Dale said, City of Charleston passed an amendment to their flood ordinance in April. This impacts new single-family dwellings for proposed construction within AE and VE flood zones. This won't go into effect until January 1 of 2024. So this is just kind of showing what the prohibited foundation types will be. Really, it's just slab on grade. We don't have basements here in the Lowcountry, but they threw that in their ordinance wording. So effects on fill on the landscape. So the ordinance, as Dale stated, it does not explicitly limit lot filling. It just controls the type of elevation foundation for those homes, and it doesn't increase the finished floor elevation of structure. So they haven't added any more freeboard. Most of the county is at a 2-foot freeboard. That's what the town Mount Pleasant is at. It does require crawl space foundations or fully elevated houses. Therefore, it maximizes that natural storage. So if you look at the little picture, it shows how that storage can happen underneath the house in a flooding condition. It also keeps homes elevated if there's severe rain or flooding events, and it does try to limit that unnecessary fill placement on lots. And then if there was a house that was repeatedly getting flooded, by having a crawl space or a fully elevated home, it makes it easier to further elevate it if it's needed. You know, it's easier to jack something up that's already elevated rather than trying to rip a slab up or dig under it. And then it also promotes the use of flood vents for property protection. So that's all the things that the City of Charleston ordinance does do. And so why is fill necessary for lot development? So fill is required to reshape the natural grade of a lot to create positive drainage per the building code and stormwater ordinance. So we have to do this, as well as form a building pad for the houses and accessory structures. It does not inherently increase runoff. Increased runoff is placement of impervious surface, so parking lots, concrete, and so there's less ground infiltration on a lot. If we have a low-lying lot, fill can affect the amount, timing, and direction of runoff leaving the lot. So if there was a bowl in a lot and we fill that bowl, obviously that is going to increase runoff because we're limiting that storage. So kind of comparing the city and the town landscapes, as Dale mentioned, the City of Charleston is seeing rapid development on Johns Island, as well as sea level rise flooding throughout the city due to significant amounts of low-lying land. The town has much higher land and less floodplain in its jurisdiction than the City of Charleston. The town is mostly built out with large tract neighborhoods, why we had the moratorium for building, and are completing construction or they already have permits approved. So I go through these figures and then I have a map to show to kind of illustrate this. So we have around 38,000 parcels in the town and 46% are in the AE and VE flood zones, so that 100-year flood zone. 10% of those parcels in the flood zone remain undeveloped. So that could be up to, depending on zoning, we haven't broken zoning out, 1,700 potential homes. Many of those would already be required to be elevated per our ordinances that we have at the town. There are going to be crawl spaces or they're already going to be fully elevated homes. Nearly 6,600 of all of the developed parcels and undeveloped parcels in the flood zones have an average grade within 0 to 3 feet of design flood level. So what we did is we looked at average grade on a lot and we looked at the design flood elevation, so BFE plus 2, and we saw where there was a difference of either 0 feet or 3 feet, because that's going to be the most economical and easiest use to have a slab on grade home. So we're trying to figure out what the impact of a similar ordinance would be to the town. What we found was that 3% of the parcels in the flood zone that are undeveloped, so that's 535 parcels, have the potential to be impacted by a fill restriction ordinance. So let's look at a map. So this is a map of the town. Blue is showing the AE, and then that tannish color is VE, so that's our high velocity zone. So both of those colors make up the 100-year flood zone. If we look at yellow.
I'll make sure that both colors are the 100 year.
Correct.
Got it.
Yeah.
Okay.
If we look at the yellow, that is looking, identifying parcels that have an average grade, and the difference between DFE is greater than 3 feet, pretty much. So we're assuming that they are going to be a crawl space or a drive under home. So what we are interested in for our ordinance, and just kind of zooming in so we can see a little bit better, is the orange. The orange is that 3% number that I threw out. That is just looking at these are the potential portions of the town that we would say, no, you can't have slab on grade. We would need that to be crawl space, whatever. So just kind of looking at that impact. Existing town practices, so we have current ordinances, practices, programs, plans, to reduce the impact of new development and encourage better building practices. So we recently have done our LID techniques for commercial development. We have a comp plan that has a huge focus on resilience and laying groundwork for collaboration and inclusion of resilience practices across ordinances. We participate in the community rating system, which lowers flood insurance costs for citizens by reducing flood impacts through various town regulations, such as our 2-foot freeboard. We also limit enclosures beneath buildings, so we require 40% open louvers. That helps us not have illegal conversions into bedrooms underneath houses, et cetera. And then we have stormwater standards for design, plan review techniques, and inspection practices that focus on property protection from floodwaters. So some opportunities for the town if we wanted to kind of address the situations that you talked about, Ms. Hyatt. We would have additional limits or controls on develop could be considered. Maybe we look at LID techniques for residential properties instead of only commercial. And then maybe we limit structural fill placement for AE zones like we have for VE zones. So since VE zones are high velocity zones, they have wave action. We're not allowed from a federal standard to put structural fill that would hold up a building, because in theory, in a flooding situation, that's going to be wiped away by our waves, our hurricanes. So we could have something in the same effect for AE zones. Just kind of two ideas that we have at the staff level.
One of the things that caught my attention listening to Dale was also the effect if you have a rebuild. Because I've noticed, like on the neighboring sea islands, if somebody remodels a house more than 50%, they have to elevate it up to the new flood elevation level because some of these houses were built many, many years before all this was there. So anything we enact won't just affect these 3% that we're talking about, but also in the future when there are rebuilds. I'm guessing, and I was driving around through the old Mount Pleasant area yesterday, not the old village, but old Mount Pleasant. Numerous new houses where there used to be a 1,000-square-foot brick or cinder block ranch house. Now we have what we all recognize. You know, they're all kind of the same. It's the, you know, the wooden exterior, and they all have the same sort of shed dormers and stuff. So I'm thinking, and I don't know, I can't recite regulations and stuff, but when they do those and build a new one, could this possibly come into effect on those?
Sure. So okay. In the elevation certificates that I review, I see mostly in the floodplains. That's all I'm looking at, right? I'm not looking at, you know, in the X zone or shaded X because we don't regulate that. All of our houses are drive under open louver homes, so I don't really see any slab on grade homes in our floodplain. So we're doing good with those practices. We do see teardowns and rebuilds like you're talking about in the floodplain since I just ran a report for our CRS recertification, which we submitted today, so that's exciting. We see maybe 10 or 12 a year that are in a floodplain. And again, most of those are going to be drive-unders. People want that storage in their house, and they recognize sea level rise as being a threat. So,
and did I hear correctly from Charleston that in y'all's study that to put a house on piers, as we know, you know, think beach houses, and I'm thinking about some of our newer neighborhoods that I've been in. Most of the houses are built that way. It's nice. It's breezy. You've got storage space. You can put your boat under there, all kind of things. But it only adds 2 to 3% to the cost of construction. Did I hear that correctly?
Sir, that's the evidence from practices developed in Colorado post the 2013 flood in Colorado, as well as the evidence of what's happened in Houston post Hurricane Harvey.
Okay.
We assume that building practices there, the cost of labor, the cost of materials, are similar they're expensive now, whatever, that there's a peak on, I'm an economist, so there's a peak on that.
Okay.
Come back down, but that's sort of a transition of a 1 to 3 year period when the labor and materials market are converting from sending cement trucks to build slab on grade to sending carpenters buying wood with peer and beam.
Okay.
It's sort of that transition.
Thank you. Okay. Ms. Hyatt, I guess I'll throw it to you. I've got some ideas, but let's hear what the council wants. Okay, if you'll stay there, that would be
sure. Well, I'm encouraged that it seems that not a lot of area would be impacted, but when it came to my neighborhood, I wasn't in a flood zone. So this was done next door, and now it's like, I mean, when it rains, our street is a river. So I think homes are impacted by this fill process, even when you're not in a flood zone. And, you know, my neighborhood was old school where you just cut the road, sold the lots, you cut the hole in the middle of the property, and you built a crawl space. You didn't clear cut everything and build these slab houses. So, you know, I feel that this process still affects areas that aren't in a flood zone. And we reviewed our public input matters results today at another committee meeting, and a lot of people wanted more canopy, so it affects our trees too to build this way. I mean, they clear cut the property and bring in this dirt, so just for me, I feel that this practice impacts us in more ways than just flood.
Okay. So. Ms. Porter.
Just a couple of questions. So what would be, where could we go wrong if we just make it and across the border, we just ban it, period? Is that just crazy? Like, are we going too drastic? And I like the fact that how Charleston was talking about how they did their plan, that they protected, that the whole time they were thinking about current residents, which is what we keep stressing, right? So I like the fact that they, in a way, grandfathered. And so if you're just doing the same thing, you can rebuild to that same standard and go ahead and put a slab down. But, or not just making it across the board, do we go 5 year? Do we go to a 5 year flood? But I think what Ms. Hyatt said is so true. It doesn't just affect, you could not be in a flood zone and somebody could do that around you and you will flood. I mean, we've seen that in Commonwealth as well. And yeah, I was just gonna, I made a big note with redevelopment because yeah, we can't just look at new stuff that hasn't been developed. But I loved everything. Thank you so much. Thank you, Ms. Hyatt, for putting this on the agenda.
Ms. Chapman.
The use of the lid techniques is going to help. And I think that the expansion of those lid techniques to residential property is a good idea. Secondly, what I have a concern about the businesses. I think the city of Charleston allowed the businesses to do something a little different. Mm-hmm. So I like that.
Yeah, me too.
Because we've got to protect our mm-hmm. businesses as well. The key thing for me is when we did the new stormwater rate plans, we looked at the size of the top of the building and how much of the runoff any new buildings got. And we placed a premium on that. We added. So I think some of the things we've already done, and I like the presentation from the town staff, but the lid techniques, I think, is going to be a big thing. And, you know, limiting structural fill, like A&E zones, is a good idea, too. So I think our staff is on the right track right now. It's up to us to come up with the right combination, if you will, before we send it out
right
to the contractors mm-hmm. and the builders to get their input. But we're going to have to get their input as well. Mm-hmm. So I'm looking forward to it.
So sort of to bring it together and maybe wrap up on this is how about, you know, we're not ready to send anything to council next week. But let's come back and look at what we could reasonably take from our low impact development for commercial and incorporate into residential. Let's look at if we were to do, and if y'all agree, if we were to start like Charleston did with, you know, no fill and bill on the in the 100-year floodplain, just look at that for now. And then let's look at the effects that this would have on anything that is replaced or rebuilt in existing areas, because we're all thinking new construction, but where we live, we're one hurricane away from, unfortunately, and hopefully people not losing their homes, but that's a time that people remodel and do things differently, and we know there are thresholds with FEMA and all of that. But what if we come back in our next meeting and we look at those aspects, and that will help us sort of see where we could go with this. Does that sound reasonable? Or is that too vague?
No, that is basically expand on our opportunities here. And
okay.
If Ms. Corley likes, I can also look at, you mentioned the 500-year flood zone and regulating. That's our shaded X zone.
Yes.
We could look at impacts of that just to
see.
Have a full picture.
Right.
You can do that as well.
Okay. If you haven't done it, and I have not read the whole thing cover to cover, but look at what's in the new statewide, the strategic resiliency and risk management plan. It addresses the forward-looking nature of all this, and it also addresses getting public support and having the trust of the public as we do this, so we don't want to rush into these type things. But there's also a fund, and I can't remember the name of it. You probably know it, Dale. There is a fund that the state has, one, for increasing resiliency efforts, and two, for those areas and homes that might have to be purchased because of, you know, recurring flooding. And they're especially looking at what they call under-resourced areas in this report. I don't think Mount Pleasant, by anybody's measure, is an under-resourced area. With the kind of budget we have and the money we have at our disposal to spend. But let's make sure that all of these things that we look at, that we're thinking, because I don't know that this would be the case, but with that recent Supreme Court decision about EPA's ability to regulate isolated wetlands, and in my conservation background, there is no such thing as an isolated wetland, but that's another debate. But the state may be taking these actions, and there is no better place to build upon than this statewide report that was just issued. So I think the more familiar we are with that, the more we might be able to see what state regulations might look like in the future. So we got to remember, too, we don't want to go doing these things and making drastic changes without thinking where our state might be going, just to have it all change again, and there goes that public trust. But let's take a look at this and move in that direction as we look. I don't think we're ready to propose an ordinance at this stage, but we're getting good information. Yes.
Mayor, I would really like to hear also from the commercial people.
Great idea.
And the home builders to see what kind of impact this is going to have on them. Because, you know, we worked on that considerably when we were looking at the responses for the stormwater
right.
Funds and also on the lid techniques.
Right.
We got their input. And
right.
Before we did anything, you know, we looked at that.
And so, we did not get pushback.
No. So it would be helpful to make sure, you know, at the beginning, that they understand what we're trying to do.
Right.
And let them get buy-in.
Exactly.
At the beginning.
Right. And the chair of the Floodwater Commission, Ms. Mulligan, who was here Monday, has offered to come back and speak to us in the town on state level and where this is probably all headed. Have we given you enough to work with?
I got my page of notes.
All right. Thank you very much. That moves us to item 5, which is staff update on Commonwealth Neighborhood Drainage.
Good evening, Mr. Mayor, members of the committee. This is going to be a brief update on the investigation that was undertaken the past couple of months. This was brought before you back in May. Some of the citizens, residents in that area, wanted the town to take a look at why they were flooding, frequently flooding in some of the areas there. So y'all directed us to undertake this, and this was good timing because we've had a lot of rain events since then. The Commonwealth Subdivision, just giving y'all a little bit of the history of the development. There's partially surrounded by Austin Creek. Austin Creek is the main outfall. It was the natural outfall of this land before it was developed. The first phase of Commonwealth was platted in 1981. The second phase was platted in 1987. And then the third phase is platted in 1994. This is important just for the context of when this was developed, what standards were in place. This was developed in Charleston County. This was not developed in the town of Mount Pleasant. And we'll touch on a little bit more in just a second on why that is kind of important. Now, looking at the big picture, the overall drainage, the main drainage components of the area, shown in red with the red arrows, that's the drainage pattern, the flow direction. Commonwealth has two main open channels, one to the left next to where I've got the wetland shaded in purple. That is a very large open channel, conveys stormwater from the backside of the subdivision out and in through a pipe and off to the side, off to the side of that, the pond located in the center. The second open ditch is in the center, kind of zigzags up there at the top, brings stormwater down to the mouth of the pond. And then we have down towards the bottom of the pond, we have a 48-inch culvert, which takes water up under the Deer Creek Road into another long, linear, narrow pond into the outfall, which discharges in the upper part of Austin Creek. All that flow goes under Deer Creek Road there. So the surrounding developments, one in particular, Darrell Creek Phase 7, was developed about 5-6 years ago, fully built out. It was developed and brought through the town of Mount Pleasant for its review. There's four interconnected ponds. It does have a discharge point out to the Wando River, which discharges into that small tributary there at the Wando River. And it also has a hydraulic connection in with the back part of that, the rear ditch there that actually allows flow to potentially go back and forth depending on the staging of the ditch in the rear versus the staging of the pond in that subdivision. But the primary outfall for that development is going towards Wando River. So saying that this area really has only one particular outfall is not quite accurate. It really has the potential to go in two different directions there. What we've received information from some of the residents and some of our data is that it frequently floods at 520-518 Wood Springs Road. It also, there's standing water at 595 Wood Springs Road located there, also at 3606 Deer Creek Road. There's a low area that has some reports of standing water as well on Common Road. And I imagine that there's still some standing water where you do have some of the red areas there because it's fairly low there as well. But there, we don't have any reports of water standing in that area. So as mentioned, when this was brought before you early May, we actually had a pretty good rain event out there. We had a little over 2 inches in a short amount of time. The area at 525-18 flooded very significantly. You can tell by the debris lines up on the banks of the road. A few days later, I went out there and just kind of walked the area. That section of roadway flows towards that center open ditch. It does go into an open ditch, and then it goes into this pipe system here, and this is the way it looked that day. While I was out there, Mr. Reed, the neighbor there came out and spoke to me and said that, yeah, he witnessed water in that ditch coming to the very top. And then he said the water elevation in the open ditch was much lower than the water in that ditch, which is a clear indication that that ditch was, that pipe was clogged. Going farther down that ditch, you could see that there was a large amount of debris accumulation, and also at the very end, as it discharges into the pond, there's a long list of accumulation there, which probably have accumulated over a number of years. That these areas, as well as that open ditch, has been cleaned. Public Service Department has actually gone through there, removed all the debris, and it looks really good today. So
this whole, the whole stretch, all the stuff you just showed us?
Yes, sir. Right. Yes, sir. Both main open channels were removed, and it looks great. So taking that into consideration, the 52518 is truly a maintenance problem where you really have to stay on top of it and make sure that debris does not clog the pipe. Other than that, that should work fairly well and will function appropriately. The other area is a little bit different. As you'll see on the next map, this shows the elevation map. This is not a heat map. This is I know it looks like a heat map, but
it really does.
But I apologize for the confusion, but this really is an elevation map. This is a color gradation that shows the digital elevation map for that particular area. And if you notice, the white area, that's 10 mean sea level or higher. The red area, that's kind of in the middle. And then the green and the yellow, that's your low-lying areas. And why this is important is because we are facing a little bit different scenario than just a maintenance problem. There is an elevation problem in these particular areas. Outlined in black is the area that's been reported to have a lot of standing water. That green and yellow, if you see on the right side of the legend, that's about elevation five and a half. And then you could see around the perimeter, that green elevation is really just a step up from the marsh elevation. So you really have the elevation contributing to a lot of the standing water. Why that's important? Well, the pond elevation is at 3.4 mean sea level. Now, when the pond stages up, it stages up very quickly. There's not a whole lot of difference between the grade elevation and the water elevation in the pond. So therefore, because you don't have a huge change in elevation, you don't have very good flow being conveyed from point A to point B. It's very simple. And I think that's really what's contributing to those particular areas there. So having come to that, we took a look at the outfall structure, which is located in yellow, that discharges in Austin Creek. We went back and took couple of photographs, kind of found a little puzzling scenario there. That concrete wall there is the old drop box structure. It actually has, you can see on the other side, there's two openings where there's a dual pipe system there, and there's a 48-inch pipe partially buried as the main outfall. Talking with Mr. Dan Mullins, he was very helpful in some of this history. He said that Hurricane Hugo damaged that outfall. And either the boxes either settled or it just got moved in the construction out of the way, but it still exists. It's there. The 48-inch pipe was put in afterwards. Also, with that 48-inch pipe, you could see in that photograph to the left, there's riser board structures stacked on top of each other. That was specifically put there to hold a permanent pool static water elevation for the lake. Otherwise, you just drain the lake out at a low tide, and you wouldn't have any water in the pond. So that's there for a specific and very important purpose, is to hold that aesthetic water surface
how deep
elevation.
Is that lake normally?
Sure.
What's the depth of that lake normally?
Ooh,
is it a 10-foot deep lake or 3 or 4 feet? 5 feet?
I kind of doubt it. I would say it's probably very similar to Sneed Farm, where it's just 3 to 4 feet deep, just because of the topography in the area.
Right.
But maybe Mr. Mullins might be able to help you with that. But more importantly, it's the storage the available storage volume above the water surface elevation to the pond. That's really what I'm interested in, is because that prevents the flooding. So also the picture on the right I thought was very interesting too, just because there's riprap on both sides. Typically when you have an outfall structure, you have an emergency overflow, and that's usually lined with riprap. So I have a feeling that the original outfall actually had a emergency overflow, whereas the pond did stage up to a certain elevation and was able to discharge at a much higher efficiency, which was kind of taken away with this pipe here. So recognizing that there is an opportunity for improvement, and what I mean by improvement is the efficiency of an outfall structure to manage the staging of a pond, being able to discharge at a higher rate at a lower water surface elevation. This is better demonstrated here with this graph. The top left of the page shows similar to what's existing there now. It actually goes about one-third of the way of the pipe, but just for this demonstration, I think this is just important enough. And in the bottom, I've got drawn in a drop structure, a box. And on the right side is the curve, and that shows you the efficiency of one versus the other in comparison. The red line being the box drop structure, the blue line being the riser boards with the opening of the front end of the pipe being partially closed. Take, for example, at a 1 foot head elevation, the water is 1 foot above the riser board structure and 1 foot above the box structure. The riser actually has an efficiency of around 15 cubic feet per second. Compare that to the box structure, you actually have about a 50 cubic feet per second. So you're able to discharge at a much higher rate when the water level is at the same elevation in both, that you have much more efficiency in that sort of situation. Also, just to point out that this blue line is not 100% accurate, just because the equation that was used for these numbers is a sharp-crested overflow weir that has vertical sides. As water increases with the riser structure having the pipe and that geometry, those vertical sides actually start enclosing in. So that blue line actually would actually start tapering off if you put in the head losses as a result of that pipe. It really wouldn't reach the capacity of that 48-inch pipe because that has about a 200 cubic feet per second. So the water level would really be at the very, very top of the embankment for the pipe to actually be controlling the flow. So a couple of things that were very important here is to keep the static water surface elevation the same, because I know that's very important. So this box would be at the same elevation as the riser board structures. And also, the other thing that Mr. Mullins did point out is because you have much more efficiency of outflow, you're going to have the same efficiency in the inflow, too. When we get a difference in tide, a tide becomes higher, like a 3.4 tide is very similar to a 6 foot mean sea level tide. So once that crests and you don't have a staging of the pond, then you are going to have the backflow, the reverse flow of the tidal influence, which is occurring right now as well. And it does occur in Sneed Farm and other low-lying areas as well. So two points in conclusion. Number one is to recommend to keep up the maintenance on the open ditches and the pipes to ensure any obstruction is being resolved before rain events. That's going to be very important because it's a very wooded area. And also possibly exploring the outfall improvements to increase the flow early in the storm event. And that's what I mentioned, lower head, higher flow rate out, much better than what it is today. And I think that would really help.
Let me ask you real quick, we're big proponents of number one. Mr. Chapman, since you've got on council, you've always been even having like a rapid response team, good thinking. Number two, does this involve something that would involve design, hiring a design firm? Do we do something like that in-house and then getting estimates on what it would cost to make those improvements?
We would have to go through a bid process. Right. Because we have to go through a bid process, we'd have to have construction drawings. Those construction drawings would have to be farmed out to a local engineering company that can do something very simple.
So in order to do that, do you need any action by this committee today? Because I think you would certainly get it.
I think it's just a recommendation to move forward with trying to improve the outfall structure and working with the neighborhood.
Yeah, I'd like to make a motion that we move forward with the town's suggestions on how to improve Commonwealth.
Okay. Second. We have a motion. We have a second. Is there any discussion? All right. All in favor, please say aye.
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 Thank you. Motion
Thank
passes.
You.
Thank you very much. Good work. I really appreciate that. I want to thank Daniel Mullen also for your kind comments. We appreciate it. It's always nice to hear the positive, and we really appreciate that. This moves us to item six, an update from about the Green Commission. Liz, thank you for coming.
Morning, afternoon.
Afternoon now, right?
Okay. Thank you for asking, for wanting to get up to speed with what we've been doing. So we've had two meetings now of the Green Commission. Yay. And I think we have a meeting later today to start working on that next meeting's presentations. But first meeting on June 20th, just kind of an overview of what we've done. We're still very much in the getting to understand where we are as a town in terms of the programs that we have, rules on the books, that sort of thing. And what we're trying to do is to make sure that our Green Commission members have a clear understanding of kind of what we're doing now so that we can figure out how to do it better and what directions maybe we need to be moving in just based upon, you know, conversations like what we've had today. So in June, you know, we have we spent a lot of time talking about what the town, other boards and commissions do and just kind of where Green Commission fits into that process. And then starting at this past meeting in July, after they spent some time and adopted a mission statement, we started talking about what we've got on the books in terms of our open space regulations and our tree regulations and some specific information from like what the building code, you know, what we're allowed or not allowed to do just because of the statewide nature of our building codes. And I neglected to mention, we also appointed our chairman, Mr. David Quick, who's here today. So he is our chairman going forward for the Green Commission. In the mission statement, I figured y'all would want to see that they adopted last month is our mission is to provide advice and recommendations on sustainable, resilient practices aimed at protecting and enhancing green spaces, environment, ecology, and natural resources to the town, Mount Pleasant Town Council for the benefit of its citizens. So that's kind of that's our mission statement. Going forward, what we're going to be looking at over the coming months, you can see there, we have like continuing with what we've been doing in terms of trying to make sure that the members of the Green Commission have a full understanding of what we are currently doing as a town. So, you know, we're talking about LID programs and buffers at this next meeting. Then our NPDES and septic tanks, what has been done, you know, talking with Mount Pleasant Waterworks on that, just kind of what they're doing, you know, what's the issue, where do we have?
Are they coming to present on
the recent grant? That's my understanding, yes, sir. Yeah, we've been in contact with them about that. And then looking at what we've got for our hazard mitigation plan and the community rating systems, as well as also looking finally at Mount Pleasant Way, just as a resilient big scale project that the town is undertaking. So, and as we've been going through this, the commission expressed at the first meeting that they really wanted time to be able to talk about these things as we're going through, not just, okay, here's everything you need to know from a fire hose and no discussion. So we've been talking about the issues as, you know, as we've been going through and making notes of, okay, these are things we want to come back to. And so that's kind of at least our working process at this point to develop a list of, you know, topics that they want to dig into. And I'm sure, you know, once we get kind of to the end of this orientation, if you will, you know, we'll have a kind of a full sit down of, okay, what do we need, you know, where are we going next? Where are we starting? What's the group, you know, kind of digging into? So.
Right. One thing that comes to mind from what you heard from this committee earlier, at your August meeting, when you look at the low impact development standards and stuff, and having observed the first meeting of this commission, the background and experience is amazing.
Incredible.
If you would let them know that we're also looking at, you know, what of those we could reasonably incorporate into residential development, I'm sure somebody on there has some experience with that. Thank you. Anything else? Thank you.
Absolutely.
Appreciate it. All right, that concludes item 6. Item 7 for this committee is to adjourn. We will stand adjourned.